I can be naive enough to suggest an alternative, but, you know, I would have liked to have seen some sort of a court-directed investigation, a court-appointed master or something, and, you know, naturally the lawyers would be able to challenge the findings of the master, but, you know, some sort of objective third-party investigation of what happened. I mean, my own personal belief is that this would have been very favorable to the plaintiffs, but be that as it may, I think that's a might be a far better way of keeping the focus where it ought to be in a case like this, which is on what actually happened.
Apropos of that, Mr. Fascia, in the book, Mr. Haar attributes to you the observation that you would never want Richard Alfiero to testify about the experience of carrying his child, that you had concluded, and this is attributed to you, and my question is it true that you concluded you could never let Mr. Alfiero testify, or if you were going to prevail in the case?
Well, it's true that I said to Jan, long before Mr. Alfiero testified, that he thought he was going to put the plaintiffs on the stand and use sympathy as the main ingredient, that the jury was going to weep tears as the jury did in the movie, you remember? And I said that wasn't going to happen. At that moment, I did not know how it was going to be accomplished, but I was sufficiently confident in my own abilities and my knowledge of the rules to know that at least there were opportunities to accomplish that, which would not have been a particularly brilliant stroke of tactical genius. It would have been something that had been done under the federal rules many times before. So anybody listening to Richard testify, and I did take that deposition, and many of the depositions you saw in the movie I did not take, but I did take that, and it was a very moving experience. And anybody that says that their heart is not moved by anybody describing the death of a child is not telling you the truth. But as a matter of tactics and as a matter of trial practice, there are methods by which dispositive issues in the case can be decided first. I again remind you that had we gotten through those dispositive issues, had the plaintiff prevailed, those persons would have testified. I didn't block them from
testifying. Can I ask a follow-up on that? You said that the first question...
Before you do, I want to point out to Dan that there was a neutral expert, Dan, appointed by the judge. Maybe you didn't know that. A neutral expert was appointed to examine the tannery property. And you say it would be favorable to the plaintiffs, but the objection to that expert came from the plaintiffs. We can talk about why or how in the smaller sessions, but that was something Judge Skinner proposed. And there was a big fuss about that, and he was appointed, and then later withdrawn because of the expense and time that it was going to take. What's your follow-up?
My follow-up was you said it was very important, the first jury question that talked about whether the chemicals had initiated from Beatrice. Do you suppose the result would really have been the same had the plaintiffs had John Riley's notebooks and other materials?
Yes, I think they would have been, yes. I think that's... I don't know what you mean by John Riley's notebooks, and I don't think we have time to go through the whole step-by-step problems of evidence and the discovery process and the 2 years of fights and so forth. But one likes to think that the result would be the same. Yes.
Do you think it would have been the same if we had known about John J. Riley cleaning up the site just before? You think it would have been the same?
I think so, Kev, because that had no relation whatsoever to the issue in the case, which was chemical contamination, not removal of debris from the property.
Well, Judge Skinner agreed.
We brought that out, and Judge Skinner agreed.
He agreed as part of his finding that we had violated Rule 11, because none of it mattered.
And I think if we're going to go through the process of learning from this experience, as Jan and I have both agreed we should, that's not a useful exchange, because we're never going to agree on that, although we can respect each other's views.
Time is moving. You've been very patient.
I'm Lauren Robel from Indiana, and I'd also like to address this question directly to Ann Anderson and Donna Robbins and Mary Toomey. This room is full of law professors, we spend our time teaching people to go out and practice law. You have been very generous in sharing your time with us today at this conference. I'd like to know, given your experience, what you wish we were teaching our students.
I work in a courthouse, and when I began working there, I was told by a clerk magistrate that nobody walks through those doors happy, whether they be complainants, plaintiffs, defendants, witnesses. Nobody wants to be there. When people knock at an attorney's door, it's with a major problem, or they wouldn't be there. And so they need to be treated with respect. They need to be treated with compassion. They needed to be made a part of the process. And I think that's what's important, that there be a give and take, that there be a true relationship between the plaintiffs and the attorneys. And I think in a large respect that was done. I don't think totally, because the attorneys got swept up in what they were doing and the time was consumed. I wish I had been better informed that maybe it wasn't possible. But there has to be a real sound relationship and one of respect, mutual respect.
I agree, and I think that both sides should sit down at the table, like Mr. Keating had said, and to find the truth and to move ahead and to do something about it. And like Ian said, with respect for each other and everything, and the truth will set you free.
I don't know what more to add to it.
I'd like to thank this panel for contributing so much to this program and of themselves. It should be obvious, and I would hope gratifying to our plaintiffs to know that this story, which lives so vibrantly in Jonathan's book and Dan's reportage and the movie, will continue to live on in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher of civil procedure, I think that's a wonderful thing, mm-hmm. to take a real life example and try to make it live in the classroom as an exemplar that cases are more than pieces of paper. The cases are about human beings. And I hope you take some comfort with the notion that your children are in the classroom. And I hope our teachers of procedure, when they use this wonderful vehicle for teaching, remind their students that real human beings live this experience. And some of them, sadly, died. Charlie?
Thank you, Art. Would you all join me in thanking both of you? A short break, and we'll reassemble with the teachers, and we'll move right on.
I wonder where we
nice
get
work, guys.
We get to look at the check.
It's a pleasure to be with you, you know. I'll come up. Well, talk to Bob Clark. I just sent him a message saying, why don't you bring back the crowd practice course? Come back, you got the best free agency in organized legalism. And
only Arthur Miller could want to join
that.
No, I mean, it's just,
yeah.
I would be embarrassed.
And then following that, some of you have seen videos, Aaron Berger and some of you who put together, but Aaron, what you haven't. So, just after the wrap-up session, an hour from now, in this room, we're going to show their video, which is about the Utah. So I hope you all take that, especially if you haven't seen it. So Henry Wigglesworth from Stanford School of Law, he and Charles and Stanford.
Okay. Well, following Arthur Miller, I think I'd rather follow Robert Duvall. In any case, this panel is sort of intended to project forward from this conference and project forward from everything that you've heard and talk about the ways in which the Woburn case can be taught in the law school curriculum. And in thinking about this, I thought there's really two or three questions that kind of frame this issue. One is, how can the Woburn case, what parts of the law school curriculum does it speak to? Or, in fact, does it add something new to the law school curriculum? The second question would be, how do each of these professors up here use the Woburn case in their classroom? And I suppose the final question of most practical help to people in the audience who teach law or other subjects might be, what is available? So I hope that the panelists will discuss those topics as they address this issue. Should I introduce everybody or should you just go? I'll introduce everybody. Charles Nesson, I think those of you who have been dutiful attendants of this conference have seen him already. He's professor at Harvard Law School. Next is Scott Baer, who is a professor of geology at Ohio State University. Next to him is Marilyn Berger, my colleague and co-video maker, filmmaker at Seattle University School of Law. Then we have Louis Grossman and Robert Vaughn, who are both at American University Law School in Washington, D.C. So I think the order is starting on this side with Professor Nesson. I'll turn it over to him.
I've just gotten finished teaching my winter evidence course, which is a kind of a strange course to some people because it all takes place in the span of 3 weeks. The way we work at Harvard Law School, we have a fall semester that goes through to the Christmas break. And then to avoid just a big, long, out-of-balance spring semester, we insert a winter semester that is just the month of January. And then there's a break, and we're actually in intersession right now, and then a spring semester. So in the winter, I teach an evidence course that is 5 days a week, 3 hours a day in class, and I have the students the rest of the time as well. They're not taking any other class. The way I used civil action this last winter was that it's a class that takes place in this room. The students divide into groups. They actually self-organize into groups, and each group, which is approximately 8 students, undertakes a project. One of the projects that we undertook this year dealt with a civil action, and specifically with the causation and hydrology, well, specifically the hydrology issues in a civil action. It's a central evidence subject because the question of scientific evidence is, I think, one of the deepest problems of evidence at this point. And the case is ideal for it because it represents the two quintessential science in the courtroom issues, as far as I'm concerned. One is epitomized by hydrology, where although it's deep expertise and you get wonderfully esoteric experts, it's still not thought to be totally uncharted territory about how things move underground. And the second issue is the leukemia issue, where, all right, once we've got the crap to the wells and into the water supply, there's still the question of did it cause leukemia. And there, the proof is entirely statistical. We don't understand the etiology of leukemia causation. And these two questions, in a way, represent two much bigger classes of problems of proof in evidence. What we're doing is something that we're styling jury trial in cyberspace. The students undertake to do a project and do it specifically for the net, where the idea is to set up an issue, invite participants in, give them the opportunity to explore the issue with what amounts to competing web sites underneath the statement of question, and lead them into an area where they can converse and be polled. And I thought probably the best thing to do would be to ask Antun Naban, who is one of my students this winter, if he would demonstrate for you or show you just what his group produced. So, Antun, would you take over?
Can you go to the paper, please?
Yeah. Get some sound effects with it. My name is Antun. I was a student in Professor Netson's winter evidence class.
Take the mic here.
Thanks. And I have to give credit to the whole team. There were 11 of us, students in the class, that put together the site over the course of about 2 weeks. I think we perhaps deserve particular credit because as law students we are both temperamentally and by training adversarial, and so to get 11 of us together to put anything into process in the course of 2 weeks is a miracle unto itself, but I definitely want to give my team credit for that. What we wanted to explore as part of the Wilburn story is the question of bifurcation of the trial. It's come up a number of times in the course of the day that this was very significant in the outcome, and we wanted to measure in a quantitative way how significant it was. As law students were kind of taught law, not necessarily in a vacuum, but certainly without the immediacy of clients and without the immediacy of a plaintiff with this compelling story right there in our office. And what that tends to lead to is a frame in which statements like what Jerome Thacher said earlier ring true, that when the judge is faced with this trial, says, I have all these facts, I have all these things to put together, and I have to make sense of it somehow, bifurcation, or as we call it, polyfurcation of the trial, makes sense. But in Professor Nesson's winter evidence class, he offered us a competing thesis, and one that's been somewhat controversial around here, which is that what happens, how we should really look at the federal rules of evidence is not so much in their internal logic, but in the effects that they have on the way the attorneys tell the story at trial. And so what we did with this site was have two portions of the site that tell the story in different ways. One in a bifurcated way that prompts you to look at the hydrogeology evidence first and then vote, and if you vote yes, move to the leukemia portion of the trial. And then the second track of the website takes you all the way through and has you vote only once at the end. The way we randomized it was to pick, well, okay.
You can go over it so they can watch me in the background.
Okay, I've missed that part. So you've seen the me like E and I like I, which we thought was something out of which no one could possibly have a preference, and so it was the best way to randomize it. Probably the best thing to do, go back to the first page and then scroll down and click on the results. I won't, as the juror said, your eyes glaze over. So we'll just get to the results. And I think they're striking. We've had, 24 and 43, 67 individuals come to the site and vote, primarily from the winter evidence class. We announced the URL and asked all of our classmates to come vote. And as you can see, the way that the evidence is presented makes a significant difference. One of the members of our team knows some statistics and did a test of significance and found that it was significant at the 99% level. So with a difference this big, 99 times out of 100, you are going to get a difference that matters. And it was sort of a quick and dirty test. It's certainly a pool of jurors that's not typical, and we could firm it up, and I would suggest that maybe what you might want to do with your classes is take this method and make those results more meaningful. But as you can see, it really does make a difference. How you tell the story changes the way people judge and change the way people vote at the end of the day.
Thanks. All right, so just to put a frame on it, the teaching strategy is to deal with some serious issues of the case, to engage the students in actually making something that has them engaging in those issues. I should add that an additional part of it was to invite one of the players in the case to come and meet and have lunch with the group, and Bill Cheeseman was good enough to come and sit down with the students and do that so that they actually have an engagement with the real personalities of the case, and to do it within a framework where what you're trying to do is produce something that would be useful to other people and that could be made accessible to other people and other teachers through the net. So that's basically my story.
Okay, well, I guess I go next. Mine's a PowerPoint presentation, so I'm going to stand up over here.
Could I just intrude 1 second? I have to leave right at 4:30, so I have a 7 o'clock trip to Switzerland that I have to make, and if I miss the plane, I'm in serious trouble. So please forgive me if I run out and if I don't get a chance to say goodbye to all of you individually. Just assume it's so, and we'll wait till next time to do it. Thank you.
Okay, as Henry said, I'm a geologist, which, according to Jerry Fosher in one of the small meetings this morning, makes me somebody who understands the technical crapese of the case. So on behalf of all the technical crapteseologists who use Woburn, I thank you for inviting me here. What I'd like to do is to describe the way I use the events precipitating the Woburn trial and the trial itself as a way to teach science in an enjoyable and comprehensive manner. Many of the slides that you're going to see have on the right-hand side this map of the area around the wells G and H, and the Abergeona River runs right down through here just past the wells and then across Salem Street. And you can see the location of W.R. Grace here next to Washington Street. You can see UniFirst up here off Olympia Avenue, the Boston and Maine train line next to the B here for Beatrice, and this is the 15-acre property, and then Pine Street that runs down through here in the neighborhood. I use a civil action in two courses. One, the 751 course, is a graduate level course in computer modeling of groundwater flow. And the second one is a upper level kind of capstone undergraduate level course that I developed for our honors program called Science in the Courtroom. The goal of both of those courses is to enhance students' problem solving and communication skills. And what I do is to change my methodology in teaching a little bit, and I wrap the entire course around the events at Woburn, and then use data sets and readings to reinforce the theory that I'm teaching in class. So in the 751 computer modeling course, I start off with 5 weeks of really brilliant equation development. And this the students really don't care much for. But it sets up their project, which is to use the 1989 U.S. Geological Survey flow model to impose on that rather non-biased model the conceptualizations of Pinder and the conceptualizations of Guswa. So I pair the students up. They produce their own models. They each write a report, but then they have to defend their work in front of me and their pair. In the Science in the Courtroom class, this idea actually came to me in an epiphany when I was driving on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. So the idea was to take undergraduates and give them enough science training to make them expert jurors in a mock trial, and then to ask one of the law school professors, in this case Associate Dean Rob Solomon in our law school, to teach a shortened trial practice course so that his students could serve as the lawyers in the mock trial.
So it is that course, the science in the courtroom course, that entwines those two groups of students, crosses college bounds, and crosses graduate degree bounds that I'd like to talk about. Ohio State's honor program gave me a grant for $13,000 to develop this course. And from that, I was able to take a number of trips to Woburn to take photographs and to meet people, to get reports and articles, and to gather a very large database that I assembled into this shamelessly advertised website that you see up there. And this is one of the main shows or the main screens on the website. Most of the information is included under image gallery, where you saw a number of my photographs already presented. What the grant enabled me to do is to actually gather these data sets and then to use them in real detail in the course. So this is the entrance to the image gallery, where you can go from background and look at the plaintiffs, the defendants, the toxic trial, etc., and flip through the website. The website isn't enough, though, and students sometimes need to touch, feel, and if you're a geologist, kick, spit, and hit rocks. So I take them into the field so they can form some of their own opinions about Woburn using analogies in the Columbus area. So we go to the cancer hospital on campus, we look at different geologic materials, we go down to the Scioto River, and we collect some data. So the second day of class, we go over to the James Cancer Hospital, and one of the MDs and one of the PhD researchers describe to us the treatment for leukemia and some of the research that's being done. We get to look down in through the microscope and see active leukemia cells. The next week, I take them to a local aggregate quarry to look at outwash, coarse sand and gravel. It's very similar to what exists in the middle of a valley just to the east of the Beatrice site and to the west of the Washington Avenue area. The same day, we go to our county landfill, which has a lodgment till very similar to what exists on the upland area up by the W.R. Grace plant, and I rub their feet and their hands in this silty clay material. Later in the quarter, we go down to a stream that is more like the size of the Averjona River, not like in the movie. This is Scioto Big Run, and we do stream gauging, just like the United States Geological Survey did to gather one of their data sets. And then the last trip we take is down to a small town nearby where they have wells right adjacent to the floodplain or on the floodplain of the Scioto River, and we talk about capture zones of those wells and induced infiltration out of the river. But the core of their testimony in the mock trial is the data analysis and interpretation aspects of the course, and that's really the foundation of their testimony. So they make geologic cross-sections from soil borings and well logs that I've gathered. They draw water table maps to look at flow directions, both in plan view and then in cross-section view. They look at contours of drawdown from the 30-day United States Geological Survey pumping test to look at where the hydraulic gradients change and velocities change due to the pumping. They look at the data set obtained by the USGS and looking at stream flow losses due to pumping. We try to contour concentrations of some of the contaminants that are in the valley. This turns out to be very difficult because of the way the wells were sampled and the timing of the samplings. And we calculate breakthrough curves of the arrival times of the contaminants in a manner similar to what Professor Pinder testified to in trial. They also have additional reading assignments. And this is to gain perspectives that are different than what is portrayed in Jonathan Haar's book, and hopefully to get them enough divergence of opinion that they can form their own opinions. So they can read the original complaint and the second amended complaint. I have the opening and closing arguments that they can look at. I have the depositions of almost all the technical witnesses except for Ellis Koch, the Beatrice witness, which I'm trying to locate here today. I have over 2,500 pages of trial testimony covering 23 days of the technical witnesses that they can look at. And I have over 70 articles, most of them written by Dan Kennedy, that they can wade through. What they do with those is have a writing assignment, and they have their choice of topics in the writing assignment, but the idea is to make them go deeper down into the resources that are available to read and to look at. So they can compare the accounts of Jonathan Haar and Dan Kennedy. They can compare the flow system descriptions of Pinder, Koch, and Guslaw. And they can compare the examination styles of Schlickman, Foscher, and Keating. So at about this time, we take Rob Solomon's would-be lawyers and my would-be experts and introduce them to each other. And then the students decide which party in the trial they want to represent. Then my students write a professional opinion based on what their discussions are with their respective attorneys and all the work that they are really creative at this. The day I make the assignment, they're just hoping to finish their bachelor's degree. 2 days later, every one of them had a PhD. Some of them had tenure, and two of them had endowed chairs. One of them was so versatile in his writing ability, he had published 3 articles in Science, the premier journal here in the United States, but had also published Big Bird's pop-up book of hydrogeology. So all the experts are then videotaped and deposed by the opposing attorneys in front of a court recorder. And then to condense the trial down to 1 day, Rob Solomon and I have composed a list of stipulated facts that we distribute. I am paneled 8 honors students as a jury. Now, as a group, they're inexperienced, but they're very curious about our legal process, and they each bring different backgrounds to the trial, to the mock trial, some of which were very relevant. This woman was a chemistry major and had just finished a 2-course sequence in organic chemistry. This gentleman was an engineering major, had just taken a course in fluid dynamics. This woman was an animal science major, which really wasn't relevant, but I thought it was noteworthy because on the morning of the trial, she milked 18 cows. So to me, I suspect that makes her the most hands-on juror. Then we hold the mock trial on a Saturday. It lasts all day, and the attorneys take on the roles of the attorneys you saw here today. So I'll just flip through these. This is Jan Schlickman's character making opening arguments, Jerry Foscher's character, Michael Keating's character played with an evangelical flair that Robert Duvall would enjoy. And then we hold the mock trial with just the experts, limited to the experts. So John Drabinski's character testifying about the geology for the plaintiffs goes first, and he starts through his testimony, and he runs into objections from the attorneys. Then the Pinder character takes the stand and shows some of the graphs of the contaminant plumes that he's put together and is met also with objections from the attorneys. Then the Koch character takes the stand and talks about the hydrology on behalf of Beatrice. The Ms. Lansky character takes the stand and talks about the geology at the W.R. Grace site. The Guslaw character takes the stand, and then each one of them, not just the Guslaw character, is cross-examined by the attorneys. Then the attorneys make their closing arguments. And Rob Solomon charges the jury and introduces to them some redacted interrogatory questions with vastly improved wording. The jury deliberated for about 55 minutes and came back with the following verdict, at least last spring. They found Beatrice Foods liable for contaminating the wells with all three of those chemicals, and they found W.R. Grace not liable for contaminating those wells. So, in the 3 days of class after the trial, and there's this huge adrenaline letdown on behalf of the students, I talk about EPA's involvement in the process and then in the settlement with the five parties, and I talk about the cleanup plans and the active remediations that are going on at the sites shown there. The lessons that I think we all learned who participated in the course is how conflict is resolved within our legal system, what are the limitations of data collection and data analysis, the importance of communication skills outside the university, how to formulate and defend your own opinions, how to query the opinions of others, and what's the role of science in the courtroom. So there are several people I'd like to acknowledge. The undergraduate honors program gave me the grant, Rob Solomon, and mostly Maura Matheny, a graduate student working with me whose thesis research we used to provide the data sets for the homework assignments. And then there are several people in this room who helped me fulfill my highway epiphany. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Berger, and I've met most of you through the discussion through the last day. I'd like to talk about three classes that I use the civil action in. First is civil procedure and a combination of legal writing. The legal writing director at Seattle University and I got together, and the first year we read the book. The second year, we decided that we had to really do something about it because the students were curious, why read the book without doing anything, which I think most of us have experienced. And so we began to draft legal writing assignments that would then have its genesis in the civil procedure rules, so that we took areas like subject matter jurisdiction removal, which is not a very sexy topic for law students to get involved in. And the reason why it became interesting to the students when they delved into it is because it was based in context and in the character of the people that were involved. So they actually interviewed the plaintiffs and the defendants to find out really what was at stake. At that point, we had already gotten into a videotape that Henry Wigglesworth and I began to work on quite by accident, that began with the defendant's story so that they actually met some of the real characters, such as Jerry Fasher, Judge Skinner, and what he thought about the removal, and Bill Cheeseman. And by them being exposed in context to the real people, all of a sudden it took on a life of its own, so that when they were doing the removal issue in a legal writing assignment, they were actually arguing it in a very emotional stage. We then went on to also cover Rule 11 and discovery. And so the whole first year was then based on a combination of reading the cases in civil procedure and then going ahead and doing the writing assignment with these snippets of videotape that we had started to develop. We then progressed and became much more sophisticated. And we added skills exercises then to the writing assignments. So we added a deposition for first-year students, and naturally first-year students know nothing about trial advocacy. That became a real problem because we didn't want them to just go ahead and start taking depositions and think, well, now I know how to do it, so I can skip all the clinical courses at the law school, and I can skip pretrial advocacy and go right out and practice law. So we used my pretrial advocacy class to come in and give a demonstration and a critique and information to the first-year students. We paired third-year students with first-year students to hold their hand. Then we had an evening potluck and demonstration where all the students would go into respective rooms, and then there would be critique by third-year students and the professors who we could get to come on a Friday night. We've now graduated to a third class, and at this point, Henry and I now have the semblance of all the players on a videotape. So now we have all the stories assembled, and we've now put that together with more sophisticated writing problems, and I began a course called Advanced Civil Procedure, which is really not civil procedure anymore. It's trial advocacy, it's ethics, it's science in the courtroom, it's everything in the civil action. And Charlie and I, Nessun, have teamed up to team teach this class. Part of it will be at Harvard and part of it is at Seattle University. And we'll be using the website where my students will be taking the position on one position on bifurcation, where they will go out, research it, add to the website that you saw that his evidence students created, and there'll be a dialogue between all the students. They'll read law review articles, they'll write papers and post them on the internet, and they'll also have the videotape that will help them see how the participants themselves have viewed bifurcation, and they'll all be enrolled so that they can't say, I don't believe in it, because their grade depends on whether they perform Jan Schlickman's role really well and go ahead and show Judge Skinner why bifurcation may not be the route to go, and they'll have to come up with some creative solutions to sell Judge Skinner on it. So that's kind of what we're doing at Seattle University. And the reason that I got involved in this at all was that teaching civil procedure, as all you procedure teachers know, is an extremely dry area. We always look for some way to liven it up. And it seemed to me that the power of narrative, the stories themselves, particularly of the plaintiffs, were really important. Once the students were introduced that there's humanity behind the rules, and there's a real reason why you have to be proficient with the rules, because you have real people relying on you, we could then energize the students to be really emotional about such rules as, well, they're emotional about Rule 11, but they certainly are not emotional about Rule 42, for example. And by introducing the characters through them living through these videotapes and occasional visits by some of the participants, the students really are living a real case and they see what it's like to be a real lawyer. That's what we're doing at Seattle University.
My name is Robert Vaughn, and Louis Grossman and I are first-year civil procedure teachers at American University in Washington, D.C. And I want to tell you just briefly about a project that we've been involved in with a civil action. Like any civil procedure professor, we were extremely excited to find a best-selling book with chapters labeled Discovery and Rule 11. As we were thinking about two summers ago how to present the material, for me, I want to credit part of the inspiration was Scott Beyer's website, where I saw that there were lots of things that you could do other than just the use of the book itself. We began two summers ago with the docket sheet, putting together discrete stories that could be told about different topics in civil procedure. And we spent the last two summers, including two unbelievable days this last August at the National Archives and Record Administration in Waltham, Massachusetts, where we began to go through the documents, and we acquired a large number of documents from a civil action. The exciting thing about a civil action from a civil procedure teacher's perspective is not only is it exciting, but that it covers practically every topic in civil procedure from the beginning of the course until the end of the course. It provides something that's usually lacking in civil procedure, which is a general sense of an overview of the litigation process and how the different parts of it fit together. And what we've tried to do with the documents, which we've taught with our courses for the last 2 years, is to add to this by more closely linking the book and the topics in civil procedure to the actual documents in the litigation. And to us, we found many advantages in addition to engaging the students very much in a basic civil procedure course It's a very concrete way for them to follow the litigation process. It permits them to apply the concepts in the course and to evaluate the documents based on their own study, and to see students who can realize that they too can critique and understand what's going on in each state of the litigation based on their background reading and understanding of a first-year civil procedure course is empowering for them and creates a lot of enthusiasm for the course. And it gives them a familiarity with the litigation process as a whole that's, from my experience, often lacking in a first-year civil procedure course. We put together a variety of questions, potential exercises, materials along with the documents. They're going to be published this spring as a supplement, a documentary supplement to any first-year civil procedure course, and will be published by Foundation Press. Also, because the students become familiar with the details of a specific piece of complex litigation, and because, as was indicated, they become involved in the story that involves not only the attorneys but the families, in the case, the parties, it enables us to do two things that are very difficult to do, I think, generally in a first-year civil procedure course, and one is to talk about tactics and strategy of what lawyers actually do. And they are able, by examining the documents in the context of the topics in the first year course, to begin to examine themselves what the goals of the attorneys were, how they decided to go about accomplishing those goals, how effective they were in doing it, and what criticisms or critiques they have. And they're fairly sophisticated in the sense that they realize that hindsight is always better than foresight. And they're not involved in the heat of a piece of complex litigation. And it also allows, I think, an integrated discussion throughout the entire course of a number of the issues regarding the ethics of advocacy, which are, I think, more difficult to do in the isolated context of looking at cases that are in the books intended to illustrate particular topics in civil procedure that are often completely unrelated to one another. And I think what we found, and I think what's so exciting about it, is that this technique of actually seeing the work of the attorneys as a way of moving through the civil procedure course adds many of the benefits of an apprenticeship to the rigors of academic analysis, and to me is one of the attractive things about the course. The reality of the materials, their connection with a well-told story enliven the course, and it strengthens our topical coverage, and it allows us to direct attention to issues that are otherwise difficult to discuss in the course. We noticed that this was called the Lessons from Woburn Conference Untold Stories. The documents themselves tell many, many untold stories, and I yield to my colleague Lewis Grossman, who's going to tell us some untold stories that are illustrated by the documents in a civil action.
Yes, hi. I can only give you a small flavor of this, but there really are a lot of untold procedure stories that fly under the radar of the book, the movie, even the lawyer's memories. Some of these stories are things that maybe the lawyers haven't thought about in years now. And Marilyn referred tangentially to one of them. Civil action documents provide a wonderful education into the issue, for example, of diversity jurisdiction. For those of you who don't know this, the case was originally filed in Massachusetts State Court. Now, since there was no federal question in the case, it was only removable if there was complete diversity between the parties. That is, all the parties were citizens of the state, and that none of the plaintiffs were citizens of the same state as any of the defendants. Now, this is a story about somebody who really is an untold story in the book, Charles Anderson, Ann Anderson's ex-husband. They separated in 1980 before the suit was filed, and Charles moved to Canada, where he became domiciled. He was no longer a citizen of a U.S. state, so therefore he was not eligible for diversity jurisdiction. Jan tried to add him to the case in October 1984, a couple of years after the case started. The defendants objected because this joinder apparently destroyed diversity in the case. The magistrate in the case initially allowed the joinder under the doctrine of pendant party jurisdiction. Grace, appalled at this ruling, moved for reconsideration, noting recent Supreme Court cases that made the magistrate's decision clearly wrong, and the magistrate ended up reversing its own decision. Now, one interesting thing that we wrestle with in this in this book is what do we do about situations where the law has changed since a civil action? Well, we find that many times simply by applying the same facts to the new law, it's an educational exercise in itself, and it's interesting to talk about the very complex way that perhaps 1367B, the current supplemental jurisdiction statute, would allow adding Charles Anderson despite his lack of diversity. But that's too detailed for our purposes today. The interesting thing to think about in broader terms is the issue of strategy and whether or not the plaintiffs made a big mistake in this case. Joining UniFirst or one of the other local Massachusetts companies could have kept the case out of federal court by defeating diversity. But of course, as various of the defendants' lawyers have mentioned today, that would have raised big strategic issues regarding the manageability of the case. But the interesting thing to think about beyond that is that simply adding Charles Anderson as a plaintiff from the start of the case would have accomplished the same purpose without complicating the issues very much at all. Because he would have completed, he would have defeated complete diversity, there would have been no federal jurisdiction, no removal, no Skinner, perhaps no bifurcation of the trial, and perhaps a completely different result. A horse, my kingdom for a horse, right? So what the students learn from this is they learn diversity doctrine in great detail. They enter into an in-depth discussion regarding the difference between federal and state court and what the differences might be. They learn some strategic factors that go into structuring a case when you're trying to decide who the parties are. And finally, they learn how apparently minor procedural decisions can have a more enormous substantive effects in the case. This is one of the early civil action stories they confront, and they never, ever lose sight of the importance of the procedural rules after learning about this. We find that the book is particularly useful in teaching discovery. Now, the traditional teaching of discovery, as we all know who went to law school before this year, is very unsatisfactory in most classes. You learn Hickman v. Taylor, maybe one or two other appellate cases. You get no real sense of the tactical or even the ethical considerations that drive discovery in a case. We're trying to come up with a method of sort of bottom-up teaching of discovery, not ignoring the important appellate cases, but also seeing the nuts and bolts way that discovery works. Just a couple of untold stories about this. Ann Anderson earlier today talked about the psychiatric examinations the plaintiffs had to undergo. Well, there's an untold story behind that psychiatric examination. The defendants hired a psychiatrist named Dr. Beck to hire to examine the defendants in this case. He performed the examinations on many of the plaintiffs, but before he was finished, the defendants called off the remainder of the examinations. The plaintiffs justifiably suspected that he had reached conclusions helpful to them, so they tried to depose Dr. Beck. The defendants responded, "Dr. Beck is no longer a testifying expert in the case. We have down-classified him to a non-testifying expert, so therefore you have to show exceptional circumstances in order to depose him." And we can ask the students, should they be able to do this? Can they do it under the rules? The rules don't directly address this issue. The students learn from a problem like this that you can't always find the answers in black and white. There's another element to this, too. The plaintiffs tried to discover Dr. Beck's reports. Chan received a completely incomprehensible report and argued that under Rule 35 medical examinations that he deserved something more and tried to discover some additional documents, which provided a very interesting intersection between Rule 35 and document discovery. Finally, one more untold story concerning medical examinations. The defendants scheduled physical examinations of all the plaintiffs. Jan negotiated with the defendant's attorneys a protocol describing how the medical examinations should go forth. This is something that would not appear in most discovery textbooks that jump right to the Supreme Court controversies about medical examinations. So when the examining doctors had examined a few of the plaintiffs, they noticed that some of them were complaining of nasal stuffiness, and they asked, "Have you ever received an allergy test?" A few of them said no. And the doctors, I would assume in good faith as physicians, recommended that they get them, and the plaintiffs agreed to get them. When Jan heard that these examinations were going on, he immediately called off the examinations in a great rage. Now, part of this rage was based on a confusion about the difference between a scratch test, a relatively harmless allergy test, and a skin patch test, which actually exposes people to great danger, especially in the event of immunodeficiency. But in any case, the defendants moved to compel the continuation of the exams, and it led to a fascinating clash of medical and legal standards. There was one exchange where between Jan and the court where Jan said, Your Honor, I am not going to stand in the way of any appropriate treatment for my plaintiff. I care about the people I represent, and I care enough about them that I don't want them subjected to the doctor, to doctors that don't represent their interests. Skinner responds, You don't make the judgment about what is appropriate either. If they want it, they can have it. You are not their guardians. You are just their attorney, which raises all kinds of fascinating issues. Well, isn't he, in a sense, their guardian? Isn't he a guardian of their legal interest? The interesting outcome of this case is not only did those examinations go forward, but Skinner ended up ordering Catherine Gamache not only to have a scratch test, but a sinus x-ray, because he said that she could not change her mind for legal rather than medical reasons, and he concluded that when she changed her mind, it had been for legal rather than medical reasons. I asked, is that a clear rule that she cannot change her mind for legal rather than medical reasons, especially in a situation when the consent she gave arguably was not really consent in the first place? This is a procedure problem simply not answered on the face of Rule 35. Students must turn to other sources to answer the questions raised. What can be done to protect the party's interests in such a situation? And finally, this dispute raises the $100,000 question as to all discovery, indeed all litigation, as we've learned this weekend. Is it a search for truth or an instrument to resolve disputes? The dispute raises interesting questions regarding attorney-client privilege, not to mention the attorney-client relationship, not to mention the doctor-patient relationship. Should we assume that clients are always in a helpless, vulnerable position in which the lawyer always knows better than they do what is best for them, or do we want to give the client some autonomy in the situation to decide what's best for themselves? These are just two of many, many fascinating stories that we've uncovered by looking at these documents. I could speak about this all day, but I think we should open up the forum for questions. But thank you for listening to me.
Actually, I hate to contradict the esteemed panelists, but due to the lateness of the hour, we're not going to have any official question and answer period. It will be an informal session that will happen over the course of a reception, which Conley is going to explain to you in a minute. I just want to offer two observations of what the panelists have said today. One is, none of them directly answered my question about whether this material is creating a new part, adding something new to a law school curriculum, or is it just
yes.
merely teaching things? I think you all could understand the answer from there. Nonetheless, it was implicit in what they said. It seems to be an exciting new addition to a law school curriculum and other curriculums. The second observation is something I should have said at the outset, but since I'm not Arthur Miller, I forgot, and I didn't. And that is that the book is already being used, I think, in at least 50 schools, according to a New York Times report that came out the day after the movie opened on Christmas Day. It was very well timed. And so it ranges from what you've heard today to things as simple as assigning the book for background reading material, to making it the focus of a two-day intensive orientation to law school. So what you've seen today is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, and I think that there's probably even new ways of using material that are being developed as we sit here. So I'm going to turn it over to Conley, who will, I think, make a brief announcement, and then Professor Berger, I think, has the last word.
Do you want this?
As a master scheduler, I apologize that things are a little tight. So we're going to cut out the questions. I've got several remedies for that. One is, following this, we're going to have a reception back where we started. We unfortunately have to go back where we started because there's another conference here. But hopefully people will be able to ask questions there. Also on our website, which I hope most of you know is www.acivilaction.org, not to be confused with all of the other options that there are. We're going to set up discussion groups so people could post suggestions or start discussions on the web, and hopefully some meaningful discussions can take place there. I'm going to get Ben to pass out some blank sheets of paper. I'm sort of standing here also, and Professor Nesson said he had to fly away to something else in another country. But one of the things that we often do, and he especially likes to do, is just to give out a blank sheet of paper to sort of get some feedback on the event and on the project as a whole. I've written down on the back of my name card what you're supposed to write on the blank sheet of paper, but feel free, obviously, to stray from the specific instructions, which are, the most important thing is, what's your biggest thought from today? What's your biggest, most important thought? What would you like to say directly to us, both, I guess, as organizers of the conference or to as organizers of the larger project? What would you like to say, you know, directly to us? And lastly, would you be willing to have it shared, either sign your name or anonymously? So if you're willing to have it shared, just write, I guess, share somewhere on there. We'll collect them as people walk out. The other thing that I want to say is that, you know, we hope that our website will grow as a resource for people who use the case. Already it's got a lot of links and a fair amount of information. We certainly hope that will grow. I think one of the more significant things that we'll be able to offer is, in fact, the record of this conference. I know all of you couldn't see all 12 sessions that took place this morning. So we're going to have those up in audio and video on the website, as well as figuring out some way to provide them in hard copies. It's our estimate that it's going to take us at the most 3 weeks to pop everything up on the web so that you can see it. But we hope maybe we can do it a little faster. I've got most of your email addresses if you registered. If I don't have your email address, you can either call me with that or visit the website and let me know what it is. That's where you should turn for information about getting conference tapes. So I'm going to turn it over to Marilyn to wrap it up. Let me just say, in terms of what the schedule is now, like I said earlier, Marilyn and Henry, which you've heard about, have done this video. They've got one segment of it here that they're going to show after this, so please see that if you haven't. If you have already seen that, we can go ahead and move over to the receptionist and pound, and then the rest of you can follow. And thanks very much.
On behalf of Charlie, who is actually just going to another country instead of to the moon, although we could all imagine that he could explore new territory easily, I want to thank you on behalf of the Berkman Center and Films for Justice Institute at Seattle University, which has sponsored the conference. And we really, really look forward to a dialogue on the website and contact in the future. So thank you all for coming. And again, we'll be showing the videotape that we use in teaching, and it will be available for sale. This is just the first segment. That's it. Yeah. And I'll be in touch because you have such great images. Oh, no, I know that.